This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. I am Dan Clark. Yes, we have a great show today. We have two guests on, both pre-recorded. They're wonderful interviews with two very talented ladies. We have coming up Roisin Conaty, who is a brilliant stand-up comedian. She you will know her from her various appearances on things like 8 out of 10 Cats and various panel shows, but she has her own sitcom coming up in the autumn. So this is an early plug for her in August. She is hoping you'll remember this conversation and tune in, I think it's out in October. And also we have Ingrid Oliver, who you may know from the double act Watson and Oliver. She is currently in Edinburgh doing the festival on her own, and I think she's already got some nice reviews for her show. We had a great chat. Some of you will know her probably not so much for her comedy work, but more for Doctor Who, which is probably mixed blessings for her, I think, when you put so much work into your own stuff and then you do a small part in a show, or a regular part, I should say, and then suddenly that's the thing you are known for the most, which we talk about a bit. It's very funny. I just wanted to discuss, before we go on to the interviews, some of my favourite shows that have been on this year so far. It's August and there's been some great TV shows. And you know what? I think it's a really, really good time for women in television and in films and in comedy. You know, we've had some great shows over the years, but this year it's like my three favourite shows by far have been shows either about women, written by women, directed by women, and those shows are Big Little Lies, which was the HBO show that was out earlier this year starring Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, loads of brilliant actors in that. And it was such a good show. It was written by David E. Kelly, who is responsible for, I think he did Ally McBeal and L.A. Law and lots of other shows. But it's such a beautifully written, crafted show, directed by the director of Dallas Buyers Club. If you haven't seen it yet, download it from Amazon or Netflix or wherever it's on. It's going to be on the internet somewhere, but do pay for it. I don't encourage piracy, but or don't. I actually don't give a shit. I'm sure they've got lots of money. It's a brilliant show. Big Little Lies. That was such a great way to start the year. Then a month or so ago, the comedy Glow, which is about the female wrestlers. That was based on a true story, bizarrely, and that was one of my favourite comedies in like a year or so. I love that show. I love the tone of it, how they sort of managed to get the drama and comedy sort of just spot on. Alison Brie, superb. I've always thought she's a great comedy actress. Mark Maron, you know, he's a bit of a hero, especially if you do radio and podcasts and stuff. He's the man, and he's amazing in it. I'm going to be honest, and I watched his own show, and whilst I liked it, I didn't think I wasn't going, hey, Mark Maron, he's an amazing actor. But in Glow, he's so good. It's one of those roles where you think, hang on, is he even saying lines? This just seems like he's turned up and is talking, and that's a compliment. The other actor I always think of like that is John Slattery from Mad Men, who played Roger Sterling. It's like, is there any difference between when the camera's rolling and when he's just talking off camera? It's that natural. So Glow, check that out. That's a Netflix show. I did that in like three sittings. I think that was it's funny and it's emotional, and it's got this cool sort of 80s feel without being too pastiche. And just this week I have binged Top of the Lake, the second series. Again, another show with three amazing strong leads from female characters, written and created by Jane Campion. Elizabeth Moss, I mean, she's just incredible. There's The Handmaid's Tale, which I haven't seen yet, and I'm sure that's amazing as well, but she's just phenomenal. If you're a performer or actor in any way, it's almost depressing how good she is. Gwendolyn Christie's very funny in it, very good. And Nicole Kidman, again, two shows with her in it. She is just phenomenal in Top of the Lake. It is such a brilliant transformation. She's all the, like, she's got these weird teeth that she's put in and freckles added, and there's other stuff going on in her face and not Botox, and, you know, like actual choices for the character, and it works. It doesn't feel like it's just for her own sort of fun to get in the makeup box. It actually adds something to the character. But this show, Top of the Lake, this show, it sort of blows me away because not only is it a brilliant drama that's beautifully written, beautifully acted, beautifully shot as well, so well directed, but it's a drama and it's a thriller, but yet some of the dialogue and characters are funnier and quirkier than you would get in comedy. And it doesn't ruin it, it sort of adds to it. I can't sing the praises of this show enough. It is such a good show. Watch it. I think it's on the whole series on iPlayer. I'm very excited about the work that's being done at the moment out there. And I'm very excited that you're going to get to hear two other very, very talented female talent on the show today. So let's start with, of course, Roisin and her choice. We get our guests to pick songs or pieces of score from TV shows and films. Her first choice is from the film Sleepless in Seattle. And this is by Joe Cocker, who is one of the few people to ever actually cover the Beatles and do it better than the Beatles. But this is Bye Bye Blackbird from Sleepless in Seattle.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
You realise just how much the guy from The Commitments sounds exactly like Joe Cocker. So that's Joe Cocker, that was Bye Bye Blackbird, and that was our guest today's choice from a film. That guest is Roisin?
Roisin.
Why do I always get this wrong? Roisin Conaty. Conaty. Roisin.
Yeah.
Why did you pick that song?
I was going to say, why did you pick that name?
Why did you pick that name? Well, actually, why did you get given that name?
Irish parents who moved to the 70s. Yeah. And they had very non-Irish names, like Margaret and Charlie. They just got all Irish when they came to England, so I got...
It was leaving Ireland that made them even more Irish than before.
So I think about 50% of my life is... Where's that name? Whoever I meet, I've never had a conversation where they go, oh... So it's quite weird to meet someone. It must be nice to go, Dan. They go, cool, and move on with it. With me, everyone's like, oh, it's got a lot better now because the internet, there's more Roisins. But when I was a kid, it was, I've never really had an opener where I don't do the bit about my name.
So why did you pick that song? It's from what film did you say that?
Sleepers in Seattle.
Oh. I can't make that noise. Because it's sort of like...
It's an amazing film.
When I think of films like that, I just think, wow, that's like an era of movies that just don't get made anymore, that kind of straight down the line rom-coms.
It's just incredible. I love that film so much. And it's, you know what it is as well? It's a really great location because all the rom-coms, everyone goes, New York's good, right?
Yeah.
Let's just film every rom-com there forever. So you get no new imagery. But in that Seattle, and I've never seen Seattle before. Have you seen Seattle in a film?
Singles. Have you seen
that? Yes. Was that after?
I think that was... I can't remember when it is. Around the same time.
But I just think the imagery in it is really beautiful, which I love the film, but I really like the fact that it's a different location as well.
Definitely.
She's sitting like near the water when this song's on. I remember thinking, it's nice it's not New York for once. It doesn't happen in New York.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to have New York in it.
A tiny bit of it.
You can't have a rom-com without a flash to New York.
Yes. Well, in a way, I feel like they let everyone down by doing that at the end. They gave in. So thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to chat a bit about your show that's coming out in the autumn.
Okay.
Game Face.
Yes.
Tell me a bit about Game Face. Now, I remember you did a pilot a few years ago. What's taken so long to get to a series?
They didn't commission it.
What? But they did. It's coming out.
But they commissioned it like 3 years later or 2 years later.
How does that work? So I've got a lot of ideas that didn't get made that
I
maybe...
So it started off as Blaps, and then I went for a meeting. They're like, we're not going to put the Blaps out. I thought, what? I've done a good job. We're going to give you a pilot. I was like, way.
Okay.
Well, actually, it's even longer though. In 2010, Channel 4 commissioned me to write a script, and then sort of nothing happened with it. But I mean, nothing happened.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, how bad is my script? Oh, God. And then.
So when did you do the Blap?
2000 and what year are we in now? 17, 2014 maybe? 13, 14?
Okay. They commissioned a pilot script first, then it became a Blap.
No, the Blaps were separate, and then a different commissioner read my script and he said, I want this thing from... Yeah. So you have to combine the Blaps with the script.
Okay.
And then I made the pilot.
Right. What year did you make the pilot?
I think it might have been 2014. I think it went out in April 2014. Yeah. So I think I might have made it. I need to get this right.
Treat this as like a sort of like a dress rehearsal for all the PR you do in the autumn.
I think it went out 3 years ago.
I think I even auditioned for your pilot. Or
I wasn't there, was I?
No.
Oh.
Maybe
I was in Edinburgh, that's why.
I seem to remember like getting an email saying, were you going to read for this? And I'm sure I did. Anyway, that's why I got you in. Because why didn't you get...
I was in Edinburgh for most of the pilot.
Right.
So they would put people on tape, but I didn't have as much say.
You weren't there for the filming of it, though.
I was there.
That's why it took 3 years to get to a series. Because you're like, listen, this whole thing about your show that you're not in, we're not sure about that.
And then they didn't say no, they just didn't say yes. So that's sort of how they did it. Because I said, it's a no, right? And they're like, no, we haven't said no. And I was like, but the years would indicate that's what's happened. Oh, and then they were like, oh, you know. And so I
think this is the only industry where people can let you wait that long. I mean, I've got so many things I'm waiting to hear on that have been months, some years.
But then it was just sort of, it was genuinely out of nowhere. Like, there was no sort of... It didn't feel like that was where it was going at all. Mm-hmm. towards when it got commissioned. Obviously, they did like the show and they're really supportive of the show, and there's all politics and people wanting stuff at different times and what channel it's going to be on, I suppose. And I think they all liked the... Because the pilot did well, and not in an arrogant way, but it was one of those just lucky things. It went out after Derek on a really big night. And so it got, like, you know, a lot of viewers, and it done quite well on Twitter. Like, it trended on Twitter with no, you know, people. So I was a bit like, well, that's really... So, and then they sort of said, well, see. And I said, I'm not really going to do better than that. Like, as a pilot, to go out with nothing, that's sort of the best I could have done, really.
Yeah.
So I was sort of thinking, they're not going to change their mind. There's nothing that's going to happen that they're going to go, oh, but now this, you know. But it did. It was really quite odd. I was delighted, but I was stunned. I felt like, I literally said this, it felt like an ex showing up, and I was like, I don't know. What did we used to do?
Yeah.
And I was a bit like, I don't know, I thought I wanted, it felt quite weird. And then I sort of had to go back, because you do start moving on, you're doing other things.
Well, also, presumably, and I wanted to talk about this, because I've seen an episode, and which I really enjoyed. And
thank you.
But, like, knowing that it took a bit of time to go from pilot, did anything in your life change? I mean, I wrote a show that, by even, like, almost halfway through it, I started to feel like, me, the person, was sort of like over that world and character a bit. Like, I wanted to write about different things.
Yeah.
So 3 years, did you not think like, well, I've kind of changed a bit?
I did change it. And I think, to be fair to them, they did let me, and also it's E4, which is quite a youth channel. And I was, I don't want to write like she was 23. The difference between being like not where you are at 23 is so different to being when you're 30, you know. I was like, I don't want to be like, oh, I'm a bit of a, I was like, there's more implications. And I wanted it to,
not being where you are at 23 can fuck off.
Exactly, when you're 23, you're like, everyone needs to know how much I'm struggling. It really feels real.
You
like,
do feel
oh my
it
god,
at the time,
I'm nearly 25.
Of course.
Oh my god, I'm ruined. Yeah. Like, you know, kind of, you constantly, and then you sort of go, and you can write that script still where it's just, you know, but I felt like, oh, it's a bit dishonest. It's not. And so I felt, yeah, totally things, and you have, I wanted it to, the show I wanted to make, I wanted it to feel quite real.
Yeah.
And that felt, and make her not a goon, and that's quite hard, because I think, you know, that's sort of my natural instinct, is to be quite like a goon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as much as I can, as much as I could, I made the show I sort of wanted to, and it feels like someone at the right time. Like, I don't think there's stuff in it that isn't, that you'd be like, oh, that seems 4 years out of date. Like, if you're in my age range, you won't be like, nah, that's not where you are.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, it doesn't feel like, there's just differences in how you write things and how you approach things.
It really reminded me of Pulling in the best way, Sharon Horgan.
Oh,
Morgan,
God, of course, yeah. Great series.
From like, must be 10, 11
Game
years ago.
One
now.
Series and.
Yeah. I think it did two,
did
actually.
It did two?
Yeah,
I
did
thought
two.
It did one.
Yeah. But it did. It reminded me of that, and I wondered if that was an influence, or what, if not that, what were your influences?
Do you know what? I love Sharon Horgan, but I sort of watched Pulling, and I watched it sort of very quickly, but it wasn't an influence. Catastrophe.
What, like, fast forward?
No, like, it wasn't a show that I think, I was doing things in my life at the time, and it sounds like a weird thing to say, but, like, you know, do you ever get to a time where you miss a period of pop culture?
Totally.
And you're,
yeah,
like, and everyone,
yeah,
goes on about it, and you go, oh, I can't get back there. Yeah. I was going for a thing.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't tell you the story. I know that all the actors and I knew it was brilliant, but it wasn't, it's not one, yeah, that sort of sits with me. She's amazing, and I love everything she does.
Yeah.
It's not a, I'm not saying a...
It wasn't as relevant at the time, or, you know, on your radar.
But I think she's hugely relevant, I suppose. Just everything she does is kind, yeah, of, you know, like, of course, seeing someone be brilliant. I think mainly film, and not in a pretentious way, but I've always, like, sort of, like, Nora Ephron and the Duplass Brothers and stuff like that. It's been sort of
those
shows.
Very different references there.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is cool.
That's mainly the stuff. I think that I'm really excited by that stuff where it sounds real. But everything's real, like Girls and Woody Allen.
Yeah.
This is not what the show's like, but there are things that you in your head, I think, when you're writing. I just like things that sound real.
Yeah, but you know what? Sometimes I've felt this with stuff I've done where you know what your influences are, but when you look at your own work, you're like, wow, why is it nothing like the things I'm influenced
exactly
by? That's a bit
weird. Exactly. You don't see the joins. It's like, I suppose, you don't, how you make up a personality, you don't see where you get your bits from. But yeah, I think everything I've watched, American stuff, I suppose, drama, comedy dramas, those sort of things.
Yeah.
But film is my, like, I did film at uni, and I just feel that's always my, to make it feel quite real and naturalistic. I'm really obsessed with that at the moment. Not as a statement, like, that's the only way it should be.
Yeah. And people are getting a bit more used to comedy shows, you know, especially with a lot of the American stuff, like Transparent and Master of None and all those kinds of shows, where it does straddle that strange line between comedy and drama, and doesn't have to always chase the joke or the gag or whatever. So hopefully, I don't know about an E4 audience, but hopefully people are a bit more open to that kind of thing. Where
I think you could just make the show you want to make. I think the show you want to watch was the show you're interested in at that time. And I think if you try, you know, if you try and cater to everyone, or if you take every note, or every, you know, if everyone adds colour, you get brown. And if you try and make the show that everyone might like a bit of, you can see that, you know, you sometimes go, whereas if you make a show where people go, like, I really like that, and you can sense it, it's, there's no guarantees, obviously. And I say this as someone who's, my show hasn't gone out yet, could be dog shit. So, like, you know, like, but that's my
But you're going
instinct
for a brown colour anyway, so. I think think sometimes, you know, like especially with reviews and things, there's this presumption that if a reviewer thinks the show doesn't work or has failed or something, like that they somehow made a mistake. I remember making a show years ago, like 15 years ago, that was meant to be really big and broad, and it came out at the same time as The Office, and everyone was going, well, it's not quite as nuanced as The Office. And it was like, we weren't trying to do that.
That's exactly
the
thing.
So it's an unfair comparison.
Yeah, they thought, some of the conversation does lend itself to this is good and this is bad. And I hate that about comedy conversations. Yeah. About, I just find it fascist. Like, there can be this kind of like, you know, you can not like
it. Easy, like, though, isn't it? It's much easier.
To go, this is terrible and this is good. Like, I love big comedy. I love, you know, when it's really big and I can hear the writing. I also like, when you're doing comedy drama, I don't want to hear the typewriter. And if I can hear the line, I can hear the writer sort of like,
So I'm like, oh, by the way, I don't think people use typewriters anymore, so if you can hear it.
That's why it took me 3 years. I was commissioned the same day.
There you go, that's it, we got to the bottom of it.
But if you can hear that sort of, you know, that bit when you're writing, you're like, oh, I'm certain, you go, I have to take that out. It's just, you can sense that I'm too giddy with my own. If it's that thing, if you're doing a big show, you know, I want to make it be, I don't want it to be nuanced. I want to be
Did you write it all on your own?
Yeah.
Ah,
come on, typewriter.
Yeah, 3 years in the making. How much paper
Little
did you
stubs.
Get through? Yeah. I often got like, went through sort of dark despair days because, you know, on your own, you've not really got that person. If you come into the office, I say in inverted commas, like wherever you write, where do you write? Do you,
coffee shop, at home?
You know, there's no one to sort of go, look, I'm just not feeling it today. Can you sort of drive this?
Yeah.
And then maybe the whole day is just written off because of
it's
that.
It's just always that feeling of procrastination. So that's the thing. When you've got a job that is not finished for months on end, it's so hard to enjoy anything because you constantly go, oh, should I go to the theatre? Oh, yeah, yeah. And then you go to the theatre and you go, I shouldn't, like that constant guilt feeling of I shouldn't be here. And it's the longest period of guilt. Normally you go, I'm going to do this today. If it was stand-up, I'll go, I'll do 3 gigs, I'll do my new, and I've done some stuff, you know, and it's like a tangible sense of achievement. And with this, you're just like, I don't even know if this is funny. I don't know if this works because I'm not getting feedback. Yeah. It's not like we're going to stage and then going, there's nothing in this. You go, am I so far down the wrong road now? And that's what I found really hard is just the kind of constant sense of impending, like making plans. Well, do you want to go for a weekend? You're like, I can't. I'll have to write. And then you don't write because you're just sad that you're not away.
Well, that's the killer, isn't it? It's the, you're neither working or enjoying a day off.
That's exactly it.
You're just in this weird in-between.
Middle ground, threatening to write the whole day. Oh, you just sit there. And then the second someone offers you something nice to do, you're like, oh, no, I've got to write. Sit back down.
Yeah. Where's it set?
Well, North London was where we set it because I wanted to have I've got a whole thing about just time and places, and it's in 2017. There's a bit about Corbyn, and I was like, and I wanted it to feel like that, like a not. Where are we?
And you grew up in North London, yeah?
Yeah, I grew up in Camden.
This is what's amazing is that for someone to actually be born and bred in a sort of zone one or two of London just seems so unusual now.
I know.
Because so many people are not from London, you know.
It's,
this isn't me about to launch into a UKIP piece, by the way. I just mean, like, even
just
from...
Just can't get, you know...
Yeah,
all
I can't fucking get anywhere without someone with an accent. No, I mean, like, you know, even from other parts of the UK, you know, it's like...
Daniel Kitson, a very brilliant comedian, our friend.
Who I saw yesterday,
did
actually.
You?
I saw
good
his show.
Yeah, I'm going to say this week. He once asked me what it was like growing up, and he found this very funny, but I wasn't being funny. He said, also, like, growing up in, like, Zone 1, like, in Camden, in London, and I was, like, spellbinding. And he just, like, nearly crashed the car, and it was, you can't say the spellbinding. No. And I was like, but it was, if you're a child and you grew up in Camden as punks, like, I can't tell you how amazing it was to be around that, like, to see punks and da-da-da, and it was crazy, and it was full of colour, and so when I go anywhere in the world, I was never scared. If you like, or people are like, oh, it's a bit rough, and it's like Camden, it's fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's just loads of every kind of race and every kind of people and every kind of music. And
don't you find it weird how Camden? Because I remember in the early 90s going up from, because I grew up in South East London, coming up to Camden, where I live, not far from now, but going up there and. Because there was that sort of 60s hippie rave revival thing going on. We used to go up there and get incense sticks and tie-dye shirts and stuff, and there'd be trance music playing at all the market stalls. And you go there now, exactly the same.
I worry sometimes it's turned into a parody of itself, like a little bit. Like there's a bit, like with Amy Winehouse who,
like,
you know.
White people with dreads, that kind of thing.
Yeah, just people getting off tubes and like sort of redressing camp. Like sort of, there was a... It's just, I don't want to sound like, I think you always sound like those people, like, in my day, and it wasn't, you know, it was always,
it was
always pretentious, it was always a place where you went to be caught, you know, yeah. people getting off and sort of polishing their trilby before they go into a pub.
So you started off doing stand-up, right?
Yeah.
Did you act before that at all?
No.
Right, so, and, yeah, but have you been doing stand-up recently?
No, I haven't really done stand-up this year. I was filming this year, so I did, and writing, so Game Face, the first half of the year was when we started filming in February into the end of April, and then I went straight from there into Man Down. And so I haven't really done, so I'm just starting now, trying to write a setup again and do, I really miss it. So long as I haven't not done stand-up for, and I've done odd bits here and there, but I just don't want to do any old, and I just feel like I, you know, that's done, and I just, but it's such a busy world, like, you don't even, it feels like trying to, you know, like, jump onto a thing, there's so much news, and there's so much stuff going on, that you feel like, oh God, where should I jump on?
So we always get our guests to pick a guilty pleasure, and you picked a movie for us that I'd almost kind of forgotten about. Do you want to say what your guilty pleasure
is? What one did I say?
All right, I'll tell you what your... St. Elmo's Fire.
That's it, yeah. Love it. I think it's a great film.
Do you?
I think it's a really great film. That and About Last Night, I think, are two really good films.
You're obviously a Rob Lowe fan,
aren't
you?
Massive
A Love Rove.
Oh, Love Rove. But no, I thought they were really good. And sort of that friendship, I think St. Elmo's Fire, that sort of bit where you leave school. I haven't really seen that where... But also, like, none of them sort of going to uni, they're sort of hanging about years. I thought it was a really well-done film. And I was young when I watched it, but I watched it, like, a lot. And I still go, like, it's great telly.
What I remember about that film was just being... Because I was a huge fan of The Breakfast Club, which is the more obvious, you know, one to reference. But because I was such a big fan of that, the sort of novelty was watching Judd Nelson as a sort of straight-laced guy. And everyone's like, wow, look at him. He's not, you know, the badass that he is. That's called acting, guys.
Just a different costume. I didn't see Breakfast Club until about 4 years ago, three, 4 years ago.
Serious?
Yeah.
So that must have shocked you that he was such a badass.
I was like, wow, what's wrong with this guy?
Where did he go off the rails?
Why is he so crazy mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I hadn't. That was one of those ones that just I'd never seen, and I'd saw sort of all the other ones.
I bet the problem is it's one of those films that's been kind of lamented. But I'm talking about The Breakfast Club. That when you watch it at this age, it probably is.
It does hold. You sort of sense. I think it does. I mean, Emilio Estevez. Come on.
Yeah.
It's just. And also, I love him in About Last Night. And
so Emilio's in About Last Night.
Yeah,
he's
the one. He's in love with.
Is it Demi Moore and Rob Lowe? No.
Yeah, but Andy McDowell. Am I getting the right film?
It's Demi Moore, James Belushi, Elizabeth Perkins, and Rob Lowe. What film are you thinking of?
That is the film I'm thinking of. But I've also got, what film is Emilio Estevez and Andy McDowell? And they go, or is it...
I don't remember them ever being in a film
They're
together.
In a film, he's in love with her, and they're in a snowy mountain.
St. Elmo's Fire.
St. Elmo's Fire, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, but that... But you picked St. Elmo's Fire as your film, and now you're talking about another film with the plot of St. Elmo's Fire. That's how much you love St. Elmo's Fire, is that all other films in your head.
I just blurred when we started. I was talking about Emilio Estevez, and I just went into that, and then I got really confused. Yeah. But yeah, so in St. Elmo's Fire, he's amazing. Watch both the films, guys.
Your second choice of song is from The Lost Boys. I mean, there isn't any other song from that soundtrack to pick, really. I mean, you could, but this is the one.
Yeah, it's so definitive of the film and so strange. And it did make it feel like this. It's like a teen film with a really thou shit. Like, it felt sort of incongruous. Like, this is, wow, you're going to be heavy
religious
with it.
Yeah. I did love that film as well. Were you a big fan of the Corries as well?
Yeah, I had it on VHS. I'm going to say it. My brain just went, we're saying it? Saying it.
Yeah.
And it's a bit where... Corey, so I was the same age as him. It's quite important that you know this, because otherwise I was like 2 years younger than Corey Haim, because what I'm about to tell you is very perfect. So I was about 8 or 9, we had it on VHS. There's a bit in the bath where Corey Haim's washing his hair, like, ain't got a man, ain't got, and he's in the bath and there's like his brother's at the window or whatever, like being a vampire. Remember on VHS you could watch films like, so it's like you'd play and pause, and then you had the other button that would like play it in frames.
Oh, in frames, yeah.
Just to see if I could see his genitals.
I love that. You're the first woman that's ever told me that they, you know, because guys talk about like the scene in American Werewolf in London where they're having, or Porky's or whatever, those classic.
Really?
But you're the first person that's admitted to pausing your VHS to see genitals.
And it goes like this the whole way through that bit. It's like, you know, like just white noise over it. So we watched it recently at my mum's. I was like, I put the VHS on and then put it like
What, you and your mum paused?
No, me and my sister. It was about 11 years ago. I went my nan's, and that bit just goes, and Sean was like, that's when you were still. I was like, oh my God. destroyed the film.
It's so ingrained into that tape.
It's completely ruined the tape.
It just knows to do it for you.
I adored him. I adored him so much, Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. Yeah, I thought they were such a great comedy pairing.
Did you
watch
their strange reality show?
I did. It was quite harrowing. Yeah, it was really odd. And just seeing these two, I don't like child actors. I worry about them.
Well, look, it's been lovely talking to you. Good luck with the show
Thank
when
you
it's
very much,
out.
My love.
You think it's going to be October?
October the 12th or the 16th?
12th or 16th. But also, you're in Man Down, which we didn't get to talk about with lovely Greg Davies.
Lovely Greg.
Do you know when that's out as well?
That'll be out in October as well.
Okay, wow.
So, yeah, I'll be leaving the country.
Or reaping the rewards. Yeah. And this is Cry Little Sister from the theme of The Lost Boys by the prolific, I say in, well, he may be, but this was his only hit, by Gerard McMahon.
Love is with you.
with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Why didn't you tell me?
What?
To bring along my harmonica.
What made you pick that, Ingrid?
What made me pick that was that Sound of Music was one of the films I remember watching as a child, sort of once a day, in that way you do when you're a child, sort of obsessively, for about a year. And because my father is half German, or my father's German, I'm half German, so for some reason that whole film and that particularly that song, and he was quite a stern man.
So when really living up to the stereotype.
So yeah. when I saw that in the film and listened to that song, I used to cry because it reminded me of me and my dad.
Oh, that is...
Hey, everyone.
that is adorable.
Yeah.
Hey, just quickly about Germans, right?
Yeah.
So you're half German.
Correct.
Well, okay. You know, the stereotype of them being quite serious is complete bullshit. Well, not bullshit, but they have a great sense of humour, don't you think?
They have a sense of humour, certainly. I don't know.
I think they've got a really quirky, odd...
Well, they love a bit of... slapstick. They love a bit of Mr. Bean. They love a bit of Benny Hill. The biggest sort of comedians in Germany.
All our greats.
All the greats. they love big silly humour.
Yeah.
I think it's quite different from English humour. So either you're into that or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God bless them. And like the French, I was talking about this the other day. I don't think the French have one at all.
What sense of humour?
No,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's...
Whereas the Germans, I think, are quite.
Yeah, that's quite. It's quite a generalisation.
It's out there, Dan. I'll put it out there.
Your hatred for the for our neighbours, well, is that what it is?
But yeah, it is.
Great. I do like strong opinions on this show. We get too many wishy-washy people.
Well, genuinely, the German thing, I remember I was visiting my dad a couple of years ago, and there was one of the biggest talk shows over there. It's like a sort of like a David Letterman-style show with a sort of comedian hosting it. I'm not joking when I say, and I've often thought to myself, did I imagine that? This happened. In the middle of a monologue to camera, he reached under the desk, got out a tin of black grease paint, started blacking up, put on a Rasta wig. The audience is going fucking crazy because they're like, oh, I fucking love this character. Oh, fucking brilliant. This was his Rastafarian taxi driver character. He's always stoned.
I'm literally speechless.
I sat watching my dad, who was pissing himself laughing, just looking at me, this is, you know, that's not okay where I come from.
Yeah.
Literally about a man that blacked himself up on primetime television.
You are going to the Edinburgh Festival, but you haven't done it for how long?
9 years, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is a long... I thought it was terrifying. Like maybe 4 or 5 years or something like that, but...
No, I mean, I go and visit, but yeah. No, performing, that has been that long.
So what made you decide to do it again?
Well, Dan, I just had something to say. Well, no, I think genuinely what it was... I mean, we've talked about this, about writing, and for the last couple of years I've been trying to write, and I find it, without a deadline, without something to write for, mm-hmm. I find it impossible. Because, you know, when Laura and I, when we were doing Watson and Oliver and we did Edinburgh, it was a brilliant way of going, I have a deadline, I'm literally paying thousands of pounds to put on a show, so I better write something. And it's...
Well, you're known for doing characters and sketches... And obviously part of a double act is, you know, especially in the world of comedy, is what you're most known for. And you're doing a show that feels quite a big departure from what you're known for. Would you say that's right? How would you describe your show? Let's practice your Edinburgh PR.
I'm very bad at pitching, which is why LA didn't work out. do you know what it is? It's the fact, as I'm sure lots of us have, the last year or 2 years... I've become quite politically or interested in stuff. And I always was quite political, but I specifically am quite interested in the Twitter and sort of the takes that people have on things. Mm-hmm. And I decided to come off Twitter
the
completely.
Opinion.
The opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, the opinion matrix. And I came off Twitter for a while and just started reading lots of books about various different points of view.
Could you read beyond 40 characters?
No, it was very hard.
Yeah, you'd get to the end of a sentence and think, wow, it keeps going.
Yeah, put that away, and put that down.
And it hasn't made me really angry.
Yeah, it was, well, actually, because I read quite a lot. I read some books by some quite right-wing people, but with a view to genuinely looking at them and not
getting a balanced
judging.
View.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, so how right? How far on that side?
Well, people like Anne Coulter, who is that alt-right lady in the US who has some fairly extreme views.
She's like a best-selling author and stuff, right? And I've seen her on things like Bill Maher and what have you, and she's opinionated.
Yeah, I love all those shows as well, which I've been watching a lot of, but there are the people like her and Katie Hopkins who are doing it for effect, I think, which
you don't
is
think
slightly
they
different.
Mean any of it?
I think they probably do, but it suits them to mean it because it gets them retweets and gets them money mm-hmm. in the bank. I think there are people who genuinely have right-wing who have the reason, they're just, those are the people I was more interested in. I read a book on the EDL and sort of things like that, which is uncomfortable, but you...
Yeah, but I bet it's also fascinating as
it
well.
It is, and this is what I talk about.
I really admire that you read all the books.
All the books.
I'm such a tidbit person. I just want to get the highlights of something. You know, I don't want to put the effort into it, because I'm fascinated in all this stuff as well, but you've really got to understand it fully. You've got to do the homework, haven't you?
And that's the other thing that having read all those books, mm-hmm. I was like, right, well, how do I put that into a show that isn't any way entertaining? My original thought was I wanted to do a show about an alt-right person, just like a play almost. Mm-hmm. Then I realised if you're stuck for an hour and there's an audience who don't like you because you're probably not a character that most theatre audiences would identify with. But I know I decided in the end that I'd go back to what I know, which is doing characters, because then that way I can explore lots of different sides of things without making a judgment on them as such. And pull it all together in an incredibly nifty ending, which draws all the threads together.
Is it funny along the way?
Well, I hope so. That was a thing. I think it is, yeah. I think it's okay. There were some laughs.
I mean, how much of it is Ingrid's voice, or is it all just sort of from the points of view of different people?
Thank you for this, by the way. We're really going into the show. This is great. Thank you.
Well, you know, we've got a lot of time to kill.
Oh,
so.
Fine. They're good.
Listen, it's not often we actually get, because, you know, the show is more about films and television and you know, comedy and things. We don't actually get to do politics much, which is something I'm obviously... Interesting. I think it is interesting that we have people that were never interested in politics before just suddenly I worry that there's this sort of almost crack version of news and politics where it's just intense headlines and the minutiae we're not interested in anymore. It's just disaster and horror, and you want that hit, whatever that hit is that makes you really angry and depressed.
That's why I find Twitter so, that's why I had to come off it, because I don't actually know what I think about anything, because I'm constantly reacting to other people's reactions. So in terms of minutiae, I literally am reading a book about the European Union, which is incredibly
boring.
Do you know what? I love it. I love all that stuff.
Is it how it began, or is it how it works?
It's just the structure of it,
really?
And how it began. And it's sort of, it's like a layman's, but if you want to understand the European Union, this is what it is. It's a very dry, almost academic text, but I'm finding it so comforting because it's so the opposite of this kind of yeah, rhetoric and sort of invective on Twitter. That actually something very calming and reassuring about the fact actually nothing is as extreme as we think it is. But
there's nothing more calming and warm than EU rules and legislation.
Yeah.
Has it changed your opinion on any of the Brexit stuff?
Well, my opinion on the Brexit stuff is fairly...
Unshakable.
Well, it has slightly in the sense that I understand why there are reasons that people had a problem with the European Union. They weren't good enough reasons to come out of it, obviously. But, well, not obviously, but just that's my opinion. Well, no, it's right. I'm right. I am right.
Be right. Have the courage of your convictions.
But it's actually, what's interesting about the book is it's saying, you know, all the arguments that anti-EU, like, oh, it's a scandalous waste of money and it's bureaucracy and all that, is actually not as true as we think.
And so what characters do you have in your show? Are you allowed to... Does it give anything away?
In answer to your, I think, earlier question...
If you could answer my questions, two questions after the one I've just asked.
Well, you need to be better at marshalling the interview, Dan.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought we were doing like a two Ronnie sketch where you get the different answer to the...
Another question. I must have seen that one. I've seen all of them.
It's the mastermind one where he's answering questions to the, you know.
Oh, yes, I do remember that one.
It's a classic.
There's one very right-wing character who's an LBC DJ. But this is the thing. It's like you end up, because it's a character and because it's a comedy show, you have to push it to the extreme. But I didn't necessarily want, and this was maybe for the future, for the play that I write, that I would like to explore the idea of having a right-wing character that isn't sort of vilified. But obviously with character comedy, you slightly have to push things to the extreme so to make them funny. So obviously she's an extreme character.
Yeah.
And then there's like a social justice warrior type Californian, get my LA accent in there. Yeah.
So how do you feel about going back to performing in front of audiences after all the actual, not the writing bit, but the actual like that tightrope of like, ooh, who knows how this is going to go? Because TV is like, you know, the downside is we don't quite know how people are reacting when it goes out. But
I can't wait. I'm really
did
good.
You used to love
really,
doing it before?
Really, I'm really good at it, Dan. Oh, really, yeah. It's kind of where I shine. I am actually really looking forward to it. That is the thing that I miss, I suppose, the being able to do it in front of an audience, and I've deliberately chosen quite a small room.
Yeah,
It's the size
of two-seater.
It's a really intense performance.
Still not selling out. Shit.
Oh my god, don't! Can you imagine?
That would be the worst run ever.
Jeez Louise!
Oh, can't fill a two-seater.
Jesus! Somewhere on the fringe, that will be happening.
Oh, don't!
It's like a small hut, like one of the porter cabins in the Pleasance, and it's a very intimate space so that you can have it's more televisual.
I just don't like comedy in big rooms anyway. I have to ask you about this because, you know, we know each other, but I've never really spoken to you about this. You appear regularly or semi-regularly in Doctor Who.
Semi-regularly.
Yes. I'm not a big Who watcher.
Whovian.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know that, so that says it all. But I imagine there is a whole sort of different element to your fan base. It must have taken over all the work you've done as a writer-performer, and now suddenly you're... What's your character's name from...?
Osgood.
Osgood.
Yes.
Did you notice that happening, like, quickly, or...?
It's really funny. When you're on Twitter and you appear in something, you notice...
You say Twitter with such bile.
Do I? I don't mean to. I enjoy Twitter. I enjoy it. I hugely enjoy it a bit too much, actually. But I remember things like when we first... I think Lorna and I were on the Great British Bake Off for Comic Relief. And I went...
You did that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not only did I do that, Dan, I won it.
Serious?
You're looking at a star baker.
That is amazing.
Best
congratulations,
day.
By
Thank
the way.
Thank you. Five years retrospectively. Best day of my life.
Serious?
Winning. I'm not even joking.
Did you cry?
I've been obsessed with the show.
Yeah.
I didn't cry. I couldn't stop smiling like a really bad loser, a bad winner.
Do you know, I'm gonna YouTube the shit out of that
do
now.
It.
Oh, so you must be really known for that as well, right?
Well, no, but that's the thing. So after I did that was sort of before I think Watson and Oliver had come out. So I went from having like 100 Twitter followers to suddenly overnight 2,000. I was like, oh, wow. And then I think our series came out, and then I went from 2,000 to, I don't know, I can't remember, but it, you know, a few more thousand. And then I was on Doctor Who, and overnight I got like an extra 20,000 or something followers, and you go, oh, I see, yes, that's the most popular thing.
On the planet.
And
I wonder what people are hoping from you from that. What is the, oh, I like that character in that show, I'm going to follow them so that they then .. What's the...
Well, it's funny because when I was in it, because I haven't been in it for a year or so, then you tweet things about Doctor Who, and of course that's of interest, I suppose. But recently, in the last few months, I've been tweeting about my one-woman show in Edinburgh, so I'm sure that'll be of less interest. But
you didn't think about just chucking one Doctor Who type character in there,
to keep those people happy? There is one Doctor Who reference, which is a shameless ploy to appeal to people who might be coming to the show because they watch me in Doctor Who. Yeah, I won't say what it is because it's a huge reveal.
And have you done any other sort of Comic-Con? You have? How was that? Are they fun?
Do you know what? I genuinely enjoy them. Because I'm a people person, Dan.
But I watch those things online and think, oh, I'd like to do that.
It's so brilliant. And because I think if I was a 16-year-old and I wasn't really into something, I would absolutely go to those things.
Yeah. I went to see Brian Robson, the footballer, sign shirts in a sports shop in my local area where I grew up, and I didn't even like football. And that was amazing. We were like, oh my God, it's him from
that
the football stickers.
From the football. The first one I did, which was before, I'd only been on Doctor Who once, I think. So
sorry that I don't know this, but I'm not a Whovian. I'm not a Hoover. Have you been on in more than one Doctor Who, like more than one person that's played it?
Yes.
I'm saying this the most sort of awkwardly.
Have you ever
spoken before? No. Have you cross-hooed?
That is not a thing.
No.
No.
Jesus. Can it not be?
No.
Okay.
The fans will let you know whether it can or not. They've got their own language. The first episode I did was the 50th anniversary. So that had John Hurt as a new doctor, David Tennant and Matt Smith. And then I did a couple of series with Peter Capaldi. Mm-hmm. So I've worked with four Who's.
How do you feel about the new Who?
He's not called Doctor Who, you know that.
No?
He's called The Doctor.
Okay, so why Who?
Because Doctor Who is like a...
Who is he?
Who is he?
Yeah? Okay.
I think. Yeah, he's The Doctor. Or she's The Doctor now, which is brilliant.
I love that.
I once did an audition.
I'm a big fan of them
womanizing.
Doing that.
Yeah, of course. Womanizing.
That as well. I thought if they don't do that, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that's very fair.
Yeah. Is it just sort of hyperbole, or are there actually people who are genuinely pissed off?
I'm sure there are people who are genuine. Of course, I think there are.
Because to me, it's not like a character that has this, where that character's actions are so specific
masculine
to being a man.
No, I agree.
It's not like James Bond.
No, exactly.
You know, it'd be weird if you had a female James Bond who was like going around sleeping with loads of guys and people.
Why would it be weird?
Well, because, you've got a point. That's such a characteristic of
who he is. Also, he's an actual male character in the real in inverted commas world.
He's not a real person,
no.
Ingrid.
Well, he's a real man in a real
I'm probably
going to
get loads of people saying, how dare you, Bond could be a woman.
Well, no, Bond couldn't be a woman, because James Bond literally isn't a woman, unless he had a sex change, but that would be a whole different story.
Yeah, and the other thing, the character,
the Doctor is an alien.
Yeah,
so,
and changing.
And regenerates, so that is literally the point of the character.
So those people who say it shouldn't be a woman,
can't be a woman are
sort of stupid, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't like to say, but yes.
Well, let's pick it up, because you have picked a wonderful guilty pleasure. I guess my question to you before you reveal what you've picked is, do you see this as a bad film that you love, or a film that is underrated that you think is good? Like, how do you see this?
I see it as a not particularly, in terms of the craft of the film, not an excellent film, but in terms of what it's trying to do and what it achieves, one of the most important films of our time.
Now, that is an amazing introduction to
Magic Mike XXL.
You're talking about the sequel here.
Yes,
specifically.
I am. Yes, I am.
Because I've only seen the very first one.
Yeah, I mean, that was fine and great.
Because, you know, I'm a big Soderbergh fan.
Well, who isn't?
And people said to me, why did you go and see Magic Mike? Because especially they did such an amazing marketing with that first one, like with the posters and stuff. It looked like the Full Monty, but with actually good-looking, sexy men.
Yeah.
People thought but it's a sort of interesting drama.
Yeah.
But I'd heard that the sequel
is not at all like that.
Yeah.
Now, the sequel is, I think it's still Soderbergh, though, isn't it? I could be wrong.
Here's my nerdy factoid.
Yeah.
He didn't direct it.
Right.
But weirdly, still was the director of photography.
Oh, okay.
I know, yeah.
Interesting. Basically, Dan, it is a joyous film.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see it in LA with a bunch of friends, and the audience was almost entirely women, unsurprisingly. Sadly, but unsurprisingly.
And the ones that weren't?
actually, the ones that weren't were men on dates with girlfriends that they wanted to have sex with, and so they thought they'd do that. They'd be like, "Yeah, cool, I'm totally open to seeing that." But I've never been in an audience of women where there was screams of just joy and laughter.
You've not
and
been to one of my shows.
Oh my god! No, and it's not even about. It's not even like, oh god, it's just about half naked men. It is a genuinely funny. It's quite heavily improvised. It's a meandering story. There's barely a narrative in it. But it's funny and it's charming and it's about... You realise when you watch it how starved you are... Not you are, I am, as a woman, of films that cater to what I want to watch, look at. And it doesn't mean looking at naked men. It means looking at men seducing older women. Or
that's a specific kink you have.
No. Or looking at, or saying dialogue. There's some dialogue in it that's incredibly feminist.
You're suggesting that this is a pro-feminist.
Absolutely.
Really?
100%. Because if you think about it, Dan, did you see Rogue Nation, Mission Impossible 5, written by our good friend?
Yeah, I did.
He, in that film, the poster for that, I remember very clearly, was the four men. I think there are four men, Jeremy Renner and... No, is it Jeremy Renner and
Jeremy
Tom
Renner.
Cruise and somebody else? And then Rebecca Ferguson, who's arguably the best thing in it.
Yeah.
They were all wearing suits in the poster, and then she's wearing like a black cat suit, and she's sort of looking over the shoulder to camera with her bum out. And it's just like, really? Really? Because that is what we're used to, all of us, is watching these films where women, even if they're like strong, kick-ass women, they're heavily sexualized. So watching Magic Mike XXL, where all the men are sexualized, is so brilliant. It's that thing of, do you know what, it's not even about feminism or whatever, it's just, I get bored. I just get bored of watching the same films over and over again.
Yeah.
Whether that be with all white men or white people or whatever, it's just, for me, it genuinely... is one of the most feminist films that I've ever seen.
I look forward to watching it with that in mind.
Yeah.
Is there a message, or you just feel like the fact that it is a film that kind of glamorizes or sexualizes guys in a knowing way in itself is...
Well, I think everything in it seems to have been made with an eye of, oh, let's give... It's not even let's give women what they want, because it's not just about men stripping, because I don't think women... I don't know, it's not as straightforward as that. There's literally dialogue in it. It sounds so silly, but there's a line where Andy McDowell, I think, sleeps with one of them.
She's in it?
Yeah.
Really?
In an amazing scene, just a brilliant scene. In the morning, he gets asked by the other guys, did she bang you? Rather than, did you fuck her or did you bang her or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just little details like that. You just realise you don't see, you don't hear people saying, and they talk about God being a woman and stuff like that, but it's sort of feminist with a small air. For me, it's not, feminism isn't about saying men
but
shouldn't go
to strip
clubs.
But would the film have worked if it had just been men dancing
it
and
is.
No dialogue and no story?
No, of course not, but then that's because we don't have male strip clubs like that, so that's sort of, it's not quite, we don't have that context yet. But if Magic Mike Las Vegas takes off, then we might.
Okay, well, I'm going to go and I might even watch it tonight.
Do it, honestly. Yeah. Best hour and a half of your life, I promise.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with your run. Are you there for the whole time?
I am, indeed.
To play out, you've picked another song from a film. I've got this here. It's from Kenny Loggins, who I think everyone will now pretty much guess what it's from. But why don't you tell everyone what the song is.
This is a song that I always used to come onto for Edinburgh shows, because it would get us all amped up.
Yeah.
It is Highway to the Danger Zone from Top Gun. Jumping off the deck, shoving into overdrive.